Okay, we want to start with Matthew chapter 27, Matthew 27, verse 62. It might also be helpful if we have somebody lined up for the book of Luke, Luke chapter 23. I think we're probably going to need a couple passages read from Luke 23. All right, Sherman will take care of that for us. Tonight we sort of want to get through what would be Matthew 27 and its equivalent in Mark, Luke, and John. And then next week we'll try to take Matthew 28 and Mark 16 and Luke 24 and John 20 and start combining those accounts as well. So that's sort of where we are. Matthew 27:62 says, "Now on the morrow, which is the day after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees were gathered together unto Pilate." The morrow, that is also described as the day after the preparation. Those two descriptions would describe what day of the week for us? Saturday, the Sabbath for the Jews. All right, you will remember, I think, that was an appointed day of rest for the Jewish people. Exodus 31, verse 15, we've been talking about the Ten Commandments. Remember, thou shalt keep the Sabbath day, do no work, and so forth. Back in Exodus chapter 20, I believe it's Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8. Now, it's interesting that you have this day, and Luke makes a specific comment about this in Luke chapter 23. So, Sherman, we're going to turn to you for just a second. Luke chapter 23, verses 55 and 56. And this is going to help set the stage for contrast. We're ready.
"And the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb and how his body was laid. Then they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment."
Isn't that interesting? There was a commandment, and the implication is what? The commandment was to rest, Exodus 20, verse 8, and the women did that. Then, as we look at Matthew especially, and you can also pick this up, as I say, a little bit from the other accounts, but especially in Matthew, you're going to see that there were some other people, namely the chief priests and the Pharisees. In contrast to the women who rested, they decided that they were going to work. They were going to violate the commandment, and they did. So Matthew 27, verse 62, what does Matthew say about these men, the Pharisees and the chief priests, some of whom would have been Sadducees? They gathered themselves together. They came together, and who did they go see? They go see Pilate. What's their intent? Why go visit Pilate?
They're worried that maybe
yeah.
A liar, but just in case.
Yeah, we need to make sure that we close the deal here as far as nail the tomb shut when it comes to Jesus and ensure that there's no resurrection. Now, would you say that those activities would qualify as work? Uh-huh. So the women, Luke 23, are obedient. These fellows, who should have been setting a really good example, a fine example for the Jewish nation, they fail. Now, this gets a little stranger when we tie in some information from John. Let's head over to the book of John, keeping our place in Matthew 27. We'll pick up verses 63 to 66 in just a minute. But let's see what we've got in John chapter 18 and verse 28. Again, Jews who were of the official type. John 18, 28. Who has it and is willing to read? All right, Betty.
"Then when they thank Jesus from Cadius into the hall of judgment, and it was early, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover."
Now, isn't that special? We're not going to go into Pilate's residence. Why? Because we might be defiled, and if we're defiled, what's going to happen? Oh, we can't participate in the Passover, so big problem. But now, looking at what we find in Matthew chapter 27, what are they willing to do? They're willing to violate the Sabbath, one of those Ten Commandments. And anybody remember what was noted about this Sabbath in an earlier class, John 19 and verse 31? This was not only a Sabbath, this was what kind of Sabbath? It was the high Sabbath. Remember that? The illustration that I gave for that was, it's kind of like Christmas for us or another holiday. It falls on Sunday. That's kind of what this would have been as far as the Jews, and this being a high Sabbath. So it really is unbelievable. And for these Jews, it should have been absolutely unthinkable. But when people are so angry, what happens sometimes to the reasoning capabilities? They're just like an animal. It goes out the door and they're not thinking. And that is, I think, what you have with these Jews and what Dolores was saying as well. All right, you have on at least one other occasion, Matthew 21, verses 45 and 46, and I'm just citing that. I'm not going to go back and look at it. But generally speaking, the Pharisees and the Sadducees or the chief priests, they did not get along very well. It's kind of like today. When you think about political parties, we have two. Obviously in America, the Democrats and the Republicans. When you think about those two parties, do you generally think cooperation or not?
No.
Not generally. I mean, unless there's something really unusual. And during something that's really special, they sometimes can band together and they will have a unified front. But generally speaking, they're headed in two different directions. And that was really true for these Jewish parties as well. But you get the right set of circumstances, these Jews, Democrats, Republicans, they're going to pull together. And that's exactly what you see happening here. So again, it reminds us of just how powerful the opposition was to Jesus. So they sort of set their animosities aside, and they're willing to, with that shared hatred, try to ensure that nothing happens to the Lord's body until 3 days have passed. Anything that you want to add or ask? Okay, let's take a look at Matthew 27, starting with verse 63 and going down through verse 66. 63 says, saying, what? Sir. We'll come back to that in a minute. Sir, we remember that the deceiver said while he was yet alive, after 3 days I will rise again. Command therefore that the sepulcher be made sure until the third day, lest haply his disciples come and steal him away and say unto the people, he is risen from the dead. And the last error will be worse than the first. Pilate said unto them, ye have a guard, go, make it as sure as you can. So they went and made the sepulcher sure, sealing the stone, the guard being with them. Now there are a lot of descriptions for Jesus in the New Testament. Some of them are respectful, some of them are correct. And when you look at his enemies, you find that some of them are not very respectful, and they are certainly incorrect. He was sometimes referred to as a drunkard, a glutton, someone who had a demon, Beelzebub, and those kinds of things. And here you see a contrast. When the Jews, they come to Pilate, how do they address him? Sir. Do you think that was probably how they would have normally addressed this guy? I don't think so, because again, remember what we picked up from John chapter 18? They don't even want to go to the guy's house because they think we're going to be defiled by this fellow. I mean, he's a heathen, he's a pagan, we don't want anything to do with him. But today, when you have somebody who doesn't like you, or somebody who is opposed to what you believe, or somebody who's typically been on the outs with you in the past, and they need something, how nice are they going to be? I mean, just as sweet as they can possibly be. That's not new. And that's what these Jews, that might have killed them to go to Pilate and say, sir. Well, that's how they act when it comes to Pilate. But when they refer to Jesus, how do they refer to him? Deceiver. He is not just a deceiver, but he's that deceiver. Why do you think that they didn't know the Lord's name? I'm sure they knew his name. So why not use his name?
They didn't
want to give him that respect. Yeah, I mean, absolute contempt. You, once again, I think, see the hatred, the vitriol there, that they just really, really were offended by. Now, this interesting point as well. They surely remember the Lord's name. Did they remember anything else about Jesus? That deceiver who what?
He said
he was going to return from the dead after 3 days. Now, here's an interesting point. Sometimes it may be a child or a little closer to home as far as a text. You can be talking with somebody about the Bible, or you can have an enemy, and you think that that enemy, or you think that that person who is not listening just isn't getting it. But when you look at what we have in Matthew 27, do you think there's some times where people hear a lot more than we're inclined to give them credit for? I think so. And in this case, they knew what Jesus had claimed. And you can go back and find passages where the Lord specifically talked about the fact that he would be raised from the dead. Matthew 16:21 and also Matthew 20 verses 17 through 19. Now here's something else to consider. Who are the ones, Jesus' disciples or the Lord's enemies, who are concerned about him coming back from the dead after 3 days? It's the enemies. You would think it would have been who? You would think it would have been the disciples, but the disciples, it looks like at this point, they're pretty much wringing their hands and throwing their hands up and saying, well, okay, it hasn't worked out, and what are we going to do? We fled. So to me, it's very ironic, very curious, that the emphasis is more as far as, I don't know if you'd use the word belief, but at least thinking that Jesus might come back from the dead, and there's more hope, apparently, from the Lord's enemies than the disciples. Yes, yeah, I think you can make that point, that they want to make sure, and they specifically say 3 days, so they can ensure that nothing is done. I do think, though, that you also would want to include there the possibility, as remote as that might have been for them, let's just make sure that we get past the third day, and then we can say, okay, it didn't happen. But yes, I do think that that's probably because the disciples are specifically mentioned as taking the body. Yeah.
Because they were concerned about him dying and what's going to happen.
Sure. Yeah. In times of grief or stress, a lot of times people could remember something, but it just gets shoved into the back of the mind and forgotten about for a bit. And that very well could have happened here. Is that it?
You find that in the fact that the disciples didn't even recognize him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got disbelief.
Yeah.
And John's going to talk about that as we get a little further into his book. But yes, absolutely. That it? Okay. Let's see if we can make another quick point or two here. I want to go back and talk about the word deceiver for a little bit. That word is used 5 times in the New Testament. And basic definitions for that word would be imposter, deceiver, or misleading. One of the places where you find that word is 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 8. Paul told the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians is really a defense of Paul's apostleship. And Paul, as he's talking to the Corinthians in that second letter, he says, I have been accused of being a deceiver. Now, he didn't believe that, and that wasn't true, but he did acknowledge the fact that some said that he was a deceiver. So Paul also had that word labeled against him. Remember over in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1, Paul talked about the seducing spirits. That word which is translated seducing in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 1 is the same word which is translated deceiver here, or deceiver in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 8. And then the word is used 2 times by John in 2 John verse 7. And over there, in that second time it occurs in 2 John 7, it's tied in with the word antichrist. So again, not a favorable word. The Jews, they asked for the Lord's sepulcher to be made sure or fast until the third day, lest anybody come along and claim that Jesus had been raised from the dead. They said that the Lord's disciples might come and steal the body. Now, we've all heard the word klepto, right? Think about kleptomaniac. Klepto is the word here for steal the body. So I thought that was kind of interesting. If that happened, the Jews, as they're talking to Pilate, said what would be the result? The
people were soft.
What do you think they meant by that? It's been pretty tough to deal with Jesus. Nobody's ever taught like he did. Nobody has ever lacked the formal education that he didn't get and taught like he did. Nobody's ever done the signs, healing the lepers, bringing back the dead, curing the blind, people that, you know, had never walked. You just can't really offer anything as far as some explanation for how this guy is doing the stuff. I mean, especially raising the dead. And you finally get the fella killed. But then, if there are claims that he's returned from the dead, I mean, it's just, you know, we had big problems before, and now there's no way for us to cover this up. So at least they were thinking in terms of a little further down the road, what's going to happen if we don't stop this information about Jesus. So from that perspective, they were accurate in their perception because the resurrection claim was made, it was established, and it really did get worse for them. Saying that the Lord's disciples could have come and stolen the body. Would you say that was a preposterous idea or not? That's what the Jews said to Pilate. We need a guard to make sure the disciples don't come and steal the body. Do you think that was a realistic concern on their part?
Yes.
Do you?
Well, why wouldn't they?
Well, let's take a look at a couple passages. Let's head over and see what we've got in Matthew 26, 56. And then let's head over to the book of John as well, John chapter 20, verses 19 and 26. Jeff, I think your answer is half right. Matthew 26, 56. That'll be Gary, and then from John 20, 19 and 26. John 20, 19 and 26. All right, Don, thank you. And that's going to be Don Harper. All right, let's go first with Matthew 26, 56.
But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled.
Okay, if you've got disciples who are running away, what do you think the chance is that they're going to try to fight off a guard and take the body? Probably not real high. John 20, verses 19 and 26. Don, we'll start with verse 19.
Then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, came Jesus and stood in the midst and saith unto them, peace be unto you.
Thank you. And then we'll move down to 26.
After 8 days, again, his disciples disciples were within, and Thomas with them. Then came Jesus, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst, and said, Peace be unto you.
Okay, so they're scared. We know that from the first reference that was read, Matthew 26:56. Now in John 20:19, it specifically says the disciples were afraid. They were fearful to the point where they blocked the doors. And then 8 days go by, and they're still in a state of worry and anxiety. So from that perspective, there was no real worry that the disciples were going to come and steal the body. But if you didn't have all that information, if you were just thinking as a Jew would have thought, then Jeff's answer would have been absolutely correct. So it depends on the perspective that you're looking at. But realistically, when you look at where the disciples were at this time and within a week of the resurrection, they just were not in a position to do that. Did Pilate agree? Did he give them a yes? Yes, we know that from verse 65. Pilate said, you have a guard, go make it as sure as you can. Now, do you think the Jews were grateful for the request being granted? I think you have to say yes. Do you think there's a chance maybe that they had prayed before they go to Pilate and make the request? I wonder about that. I think that would be kind of ironic. You know, Pilate, the Lord, we want to make sure that Pilate grants our request, so please make sure that we get a guard and we can guard the tomb. Well, do you think God would have been interested in honoring that prayer?
Yes.
I think he probably would have. Yes, you want a guard? I'll be glad to give you a guard. The question becomes, what kind of guard did they get? Did they get the Roman guard? Did they get a Jewish guard? Or was there a combination? There is nothing that I can point to that specifically says they got a Roman guard with 100% certainty. I do think that that's likely. The fact that they went to Pilate, I think, points to that. The word that is used to describe the guard, custodia. Some have suggested, I'm not sure how much faith I have in that, but some have suggested that that describes more a Roman guard than a Jewish temple guard. If a Roman guard is described, then that likely would have been 16 men. You also have some information in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 14, which I think is probably the strongest indication that it was a Roman guard or Roman guards were at least part of the delegation. Notice that. He said, and if this come to whose ears? To the governor's ears. Now, if this was a Jewish guard, I can't see how that would really be related to Pilate. That would seem to be more of a Jewish matter. But here you have the guards, they're being bribed and so forth, and it would make sense then if these guards were Romans, then they talk about the governor, and they said that they would take care of that.
Did the Jew and the Roman guards still interact in guarding things?
I've always been under the impression, Betty, and I could be wrong about this, but my general impression is that you've got the Jewish guards, they were over the religious things, especially related to the temple. The Roman guards were more for civil unrest and disorder. Now, had there been something at the temple, you could have had maybe a situation where the Roman guards show up because that could interfere with the peace. And they want to keep peace and order and make sure that everybody's law-abiding. But I would think that they would have had really a almost entirely separate police presence. Yeah.
For guards,
I agree.
They weren't even connected with Romans in that respect.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, too, we don't know how capable the temple guards were. I'm sure, just like today, if you've got a security officer in the mall, you know, he might have a nightstick and he might be able to whack you or use the walkie-talkie and get some help. But I think we would draw a distinction between the mall security guard and someone who's a state trooper. Paralleling that, I'm sure the Jewish guards were effective as far as what they did, but I surely would not stack a Jewish guard up against a Roman soldier. Again, kind of like the mall security guard versus the state trooper, you have two very different points of emphasis there. I mean, these guys were ready to go out and battle, and I mean fight and kill.
Yeah, well, I guess, why would they even need to go to Pilate?
Yeah, and I agree. I think that's also a consideration that if they...
and that might be another thing, too, is if they didn't want Jewish guards there, and if his body did disappear, then they could say, well, you know, you didn't guard the tomb or something, you know, like that, when they were the ones that put him to death or caused his death,
yeah.
You know. So
the Greek is a little obscure. The Greek basically says you have a guard. And that could be understood, you have a guard in the sense of the temple guard. Use it. Or that could be understood of as you have a guard. In other words, I'm giving you a guard and this is your guard. So again, the language really doesn't allow us to definitively say. I think everything points to Rome.
Well, not in that particular scripture, but then in the other one where, where you're saying 28:14. It comes back to the
governor's
ears. I mean, what would it?
Yeah, I agree. And like you say, I can't say with 100% certainty, but that's where I lean. And that's what I'm suggesting as far as what they were after. I think that is very, very likely. Again, if you're a Jew, do you want to mess around or do you want the best you can get? I mean, this is serious. You already got the guy crucified. And now remember what the Jews said too? If this happens as far as claims of a resurrection, it's going to be worse than it was before. So they already know how bad it is. And if you really want to prevent this, again, I'm thinking you get the biggest stick that you can. You get the meanest and toughest guards of the bunch. Did somebody else start to toss up, Brian?
When you're talking about the interaction between the Roman and Jewish guards, I thought of Acts 21, where Paul was arrested. It says that when, verse 32, or 33, then the chief, 32, who immediately took soldiers and centurions of the Romans, and they took soldiers and centurions and ran down unto them, and when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. So there was a beating of Paul going on by the Jews.
Yeah.
When the Romans showed up, that stopped. So like you're saying, the official ones came in. And,
yeah. The mall cops, people might not be too concerned about them. But once the state trooper shows up, again, it's a different story. Yeah, it's a different story. Okay, let me make another quick point here, and then we'll see if there's anything else you want to add or ask, and then we're going to switch gears once again a little bit. you've also got the seal. That's another question that can be raised. Was the seal some type of Jewish seal? Was it also, was it maybe some type of Roman seal? Nothing that I can point to, which again says it was this way or that way. But from a common sense perspective, if you are a Jew, you're very concerned about this, don't you want the best possible tools in place to ensure that Jesus, there are no questions about him still being in the tomb or no questions about him being taken before the 3 days are up? Yes. So whose seal would you want? Well, again, I think Rome would have the upper hand there, so I'm inclined to also believe that it was a Roman seal. Now, the Jews were hostile to the Lord. They recognized the potential power in being able to claim that someone had been raised from the dead. Today, do you think that people still understand the power of being able to make that claim? There have been a lot of religious leaders, but you can point to grave after grave of where those guys are. If you have a religious leader that's been raised from the dead, is that a very powerful claim? It is. I mean, you now have something that's very, very distinctive. So, people understand that as far as those who are hostile to Christianity, and they take a similar form. They want to see if they can somehow discount the fact that Jesus was perhaps not raised from the dead, or they will sometimes take it a step further and do their best to affirm that Jesus never lived. Now, I've had over the years, not too many people, but occasionally somebody will come along and say, Brad, can we prove that Jesus lived? Well, that's a good question. And that's an important question, because if the Lord didn't live, then obviously he wasn't able to die. And if he didn't die, then we're still in sin and we have all kinds of problems. Now, there are different ways to prove that. I'm going to give you one, which I think is more than sufficient. There's a fellow, Roman historian, again, not a Jew, a Roman, Samaritan-born historian, who wrote in Rome around 52 AD. And the guy's name was Thallius, T-H-A-L-L-U-S. We don't have any complete copies of the writings from Thallius, but we do have some quotations. There was another fellow by the name of Julius Africanus. He was a man who lived in the 2nd century, and he quotes from some of the writings that Thallius did. And Africanus wrote, Thallius, in the 3rd book of his histories, explains away the darkness as an eclipse of the sun. Excuse me, this is a quote. This darkness refers to the darkness which covered the land for 3 hours when Jesus was hanging on the cross. Matthew 27:45, Mark 15:33. Thallius claimed that the darkness was not a supernatural event, but merely a natural solar eclipse, which occurs when the moon passes between the sun and the earth. Africanus contended that the darkness could not have been a solar eclipse because an eclipse of the sun cannot occur during the full moon. He also said that the Lord was crucified during the Passover. So here's this fellow, Thallius, talking about the crucifixion, talking about Jesus, and said, look, this darkness, it was all a natural phenomena. Now, from one perspective, you might think, well, he's not very helpful. I mean, he wasn't a believer. But if you look at it from another perspective, you have to say, "Wow, this guy was very valuable." Why? All right, he's not a believer. This guy is on the other side of the fence. And yet he acknowledges what? Jesus existed. He acknowledges that the Lord was crucified, and he acknowledged that there was darkness over the land. Three key facts that you find in Scripture. So sometimes, as you look at Christianity, God has chosen to prove things in some unusual ways. And it's like today. Cop comes and talks to somebody. You know, you're by an accident scene, and the cop said, did you see the accident? And the guy says no. Could the fella still be a witness to the fact that there was an accident? He doesn't see it, but he turns around and there's this guy implanted in the windshield of the car. Now, can he attest to the fact that there was an accident? I mean, he hears the bang and he sees the body and the blood spurting out. So there are a lot of ways to serve as a witness. And Thaddeus, there are others, but Thaddeus is one way to establish that. Anything that you might want to ask before we, again, switch gears a bit? Right?
Pilate, where you have a guard who's secure. Pilate really wasn't that interested in seeing Christ crucified. Yeah. So I think it could be either way there, that Pilate would like to have that guard there, make sure that if Christ did raise, that there was going to be a guard there that could testify to that also.
Yeah.
But again, I would think that Pilate probably was okay with having that guard there just to keep the, the Jews satisfied.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe keep the peace in case several people. From a political standpoint, sometimes you might not think that something's absolutely necessary, but as you're trying to think about things strategically, you're thinking, if I don't do that and there's a problem, it's a whole lot better to spend a little bit on time and resources and manpower here rather than possibly face a catastrophe. People do that today. The police will go ahead and dispatch extra officers, or maybe they'll call in people from another department because they think that there could be an issue, and oftentimes it turns out not to be a problem. And again, I think that probably was more of a prudent move on his part rather than any necessary belief that Jesus was really going to return from the dead. Stan?
Looking at 28:12, right? They're talking about those who were the guards. They gave large money unto the soldiers. Mm-hmm. Does that word, is there a clue there in this translation? Does soldiers, is there any way that indicates it was Roman soldiers or...
I'd have to go back and look at the word. My guess, and I think I'd be pretty certain in making this point, would be no. There's nothing there to indicate that it was going to be of this race or that race. Okay, let's talk a little bit about what happens from the time of the resurrection to Jesus' ascension. We're headed to the point where we're going to talk about Sunday morning. And as we move forward a little bit, we're going to have the angel that rolls away the stone from Jesus' tomb. That's going to be before sunrise. We'll see that in Matthew 28, verses 2 through 4. And after that, we've got some women who follow Jesus. They had visited the Lord's tomb, and they discover that he's missing. So women are really the first ones on the site. And then you've got Mary Magdalene. She rushes off to tell Peter and John. That's going to be in John chapter 20, verses 1 and 2. You have a couple of women. They stay behind at the tomb, and they're going to see two angels, and they get some information about the resurrection. And then, again, the women have already gotten some information, and now you have Peter and John. Remember, they're running over to the tomb. We'll see that in the book of Luke 24 and verse 12, also in John 20, verses 3 through 10. And then you've got Mary Magdalene. You may remember the visit with Mary, and Jesus says, "Don't touch me, don't cling to me. I'm not yet ascended," and that's alone in the garden. Then you've got Jesus. He appears to some other women. That would be Mary, the mother of James, Salome, Jonah. That's going to be in Matthew 28, verses 8 through 10. That's his second appearance. And then you've got the people who were guarding the tomb that we've been talking about. They report to the religious leaders, and they talk about how the stone was rolled away, and then they're bribed. Stan alluded to that in Matthew 28, verses 11 to 15. And then Jesus is going to appear to Peter. That's recorded in 1 Corinthians 15. That's going to be his third appearance. So that's a lot of stuff that happens on Sunday morning. And then after you get through Sunday morning, we move to Sunday afternoon. And anybody remember from Luke chapter 24 who Jesus visits with on a road? Road to Emmaus. There are two fellows that the Lord visits with. That's going to be appearance number 4. So we've talked about the morning. We've highlighted what happens in the afternoon. Then we're going to be looking at Sunday evening. the two disciples from Emmaus, they begin to tell other people that they saw the resurrected Lord. And then Jesus is going to appear to Thomas. excuse me, a little later. He does appear to the 10 apostles. That's in the upper room. That's John 20, verses 19 through 25. I think Sherman read that earlier for us. That's appearance number 5. And then we've got a week that goes by. And then on that following Sunday, we've now got another appearance. That's appearance 6. And that appearance is going to be a time when Thomas is present. The disciples are still fearful. And then after that, we've got the next 32 days. Jesus is going to appear to the 7 by the Sea of Galilee. And you've got that miracle of fish in John chapter 21, verses 1 to 14. That's appearance 7. Then he's going to appear to about 500 people, including the 11. That's going to be in Galilee, Matthew 28, Mark 16, 1 Corinthians 15. That's appearance 8. Then Jesus is going to appear to his half-brother James, 1 Corinthians 15, 7. That's appearance 9. Then he's going to be back in Jerusalem. A lot of appearances were in Jerusalem, but as you look at the map, you can just kind of find them scattered a little bit throughout the area of Israel. And he again appears to his disciples, Luke 24. That's going to be appearance 10. Then you have an appearance on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples are able to watch that. So again, that's just kind of a quick highlight of where we're going to go, and if you can at least keep a little bit of that in your head, that'll give you, I think, some helpful information as far as what we have planned for the future. All right, let's talk about the resurrection of Jesus from the perspective of what if the resurrection was not true. Let's suppose for a few minutes that it were a lie. If the resurrection didn't happen and you're one of the apostles, would that have been an unwise decision for you to run around and talk about the resurrection? Yeah, not good news for a lot of reasons. How long do they wait before they start talking about the resurrection?
About 40 days.
Yeah, I mean, there's some reports and they're sharing some information, but just over a month, and they go out and they start preaching this big time. Within 50 days, remember Acts chapter 2 and verse 5, there were devout Jews from where? Every nation under heaven. Now, if you're going to try to spread a lie, you've got people from really all over the world. You think if you try to engage that many people, I mean, we're in the midst right now of a lot of information about fake news. Everybody's talking about fake news. There are hearings on Capitol Hill about fake news. The internet's all full of fake news. And that gets a lot of attention. If that had been fake news, you have all these people coming in. Do you think that that would have been a major issue? The Jews certainly couldn't have been happy about the preaching and teaching that was done. And we've seen that at different times in the book of Acts. So you have this large group of people, Acts chapter 2, and they are told, Acts 2, verses 24, 31 through 33, that Jesus had been raised from the dead. And they're not off in a corner somewhere. They don't go up into northern Galilee. They're not in Samaria somewhere. But where are they making that proclamation? They're in Jerusalem. And where was the Lord crucified? Well, right outside the city gates. I mean, they go to the epicenter. Less, just over a month after Jesus had been crucified. And if the resurrection is a lie, that is not a wise move. I mean, you're putting your life on the line. You're really putting your neck out there. Then you have some other things. As you start looking at the New Testament, let's head over to the book of Acts, chapter 6 and verse 7. Then we'll take a look at Acts 5 and verse 41, and then Acts chapter 8 and verse 1. Tell you what, if we use you, we'll ask you to get all three, but we'll give you time to get to the passage. Who wants to start with Acts 6 and verse 7? Brian?
And the word of God increased, and the number of disciples multiplied in Jerusalem greatly, and a great company of the priests were obedient to the faith.
Okay, let's head you back to Acts 5:41, but let's talk about Acts chapter 6 and verse 7 for just a second. Why would people give up the jobs today? Why give up a job? All right, I think that's probably the first reason. Somebody says, I got a better job, so I left the old one behind. Okay, what else? Why would people give up a job? All right, there's something, maybe they want to be closer to kids, or maybe they don't like the climate, but they decide that they're going to move out of the area. Why else would somebody give up a job? All right, somebody says it's bad for my health. Stress might be one reason.
You no longer trust what you're doing. You don't trust the boss any longer, whatever.
Okay, bad employer or bad company. Or maybe they reduce benefits, whatever that might be. Why did the guys in Acts 6 and verse 7 give up their jobs? I mean, it's not just a couple guys, is it? many a great company of the priests. I mean, if you're a Jewish priest and you become a Christian, do you think you've still got employment? You're done. I mean, that job is toast. Why do that? I mean, this is the one thing that you've trained for. This is the one thing that you've done, perhaps for several years. And it's not like, as a Jewish priest, you can run off and get another job in plumbing or electrical. Why do that? Well, I think that's true. But you want to make sure that what you're signing on to is true. But these people were willing to lose their jobs to find another career. So you have to ask the question, if the resurrection did not occur, why would these men, many of these men, be willing to do that? And then, Brian, let's go back to Acts 5:41.
And they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name.
Okay. Why would you endure a beating? Today, why would people endure a beating?
To keep someone else safe.
All right. To preserve the life, or maybe keep somebody else from being hurt. Why else would somebody accept a beating?
You believe in what you're saying.
Hmm?
You believe in what you're
saying. All right. There's conviction. A person is so convicted that they're willing to have pain inflicted on their body. Maybe permanent marks left. Why else would someone endure a beating? Protection? Conviction? I mean, it's tough to come up with some reasons, isn't it? Because we're thinking, rather than take the beating, I'll find some other option. There's got to be, you know, I can move, or I can, you know, let the person suffer the consequences. I'm not going to get involved. But when you're willing to take a beating, what does that say? This is really important. So you have people who are willing to leave their jobs. You have people who are willing to suffer beatings. Brian, let's go over to Acts 8. And let's see what we've got in Acts chapter 8 and verse 1.
And Saul was consenting unto his death. And at that time there was a great persecution against the church, which was at Jerusalem. And they were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles.
Okay, why move? Why do people move? All right, it might be persecution. It might be a bad neighborhood, might be a bad influence. You might have a stalker or someone who wants to do some kind of serious bodily injury to you. It might be that it's a job. Usually we have good reasons to move. Can anybody name somebody who moved so that they could be in a better position spiritually? Raise your hand. I can't. I can think of a lot of people who have moved for a lot of reasons. I can think of some people who were very committed to some spiritual faith, whether it was true or not. But I cannot for the life of me name a single person. Well, no, I take that back. There was a fellow in Fort Wayne. He was a man who had some severe disabilities. And I'm not sure where he was living, but congregation got started, and it turned out to be a very solid congregation, and he bought a house which was right next door to the building. Now, again, he was still in the same community, but he figured that because of his disabilities, he couldn't drive. But he did figure that he was able to walk. And so, again, I take that back. But he's the only one that I can think of that has done that. But if you're willing to move for your faith, sell your house, give up your job, take a beating, I mean, you then really have to believe that the resurrection is true. And that's what you find in the book of Acts. Carol? Yeah, I think that you would have to include that based on what you find in Acts chapter 8 and verse 4. But yes, they were willing to do that.
And I have a question. Acts chapter 6, verse 7, when it said a great many of the priests were becoming obedient to the faith, could those have been some of the priests that committed him to be crucified?
It's certainly possible. But if you think about the torn curtain in the temple, I mean, you go and you see that, and you've got the rock split and the other things that took place, and you've had sort of a pattern, a trend with the miracles that were being done by the apostles. Again, there was just, if you were an honest man, there was just too much evidence there to say, this can't be true. This must be true. All right, there's some other things. As I mentioned earlier, as I was going through the information from the resurrection to Jesus' ascension, who were the first people who saw the Lord? Women. Now, if you were a first century writer, would you have put women in that spot?
No.
Women were so, let's just use the word untrustworthy, they weren't trusted to offer testimony in a court of law. Their word was basically worthless if you're female. Now, today we would look, you know, some judges would probably get smacked. That just wouldn't go over very well, especially with some feminists, and rightly so. But that's how it was in first century life. But you have God appearing to women, several women. And then you have some other things that are kind of interesting. When Jesus begins to appear to some men, is he appearing to Pilate? Running off to see Herod? No. Who's he appearing to? Who gets to see him? The common people, the ordinary folks. And then, if that's not enough, who do you have? The two guys that we talked some about last week. The two guys who helped with Jesus' burial. There is Joseph of Arimathea, and there is Nicodemus, guys who are tied in with what part of Jewish life? The Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court. And that Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court, had what view overwhelmingly when it came to Jesus?
He was a deceiver.
Yeah, he's a deceiver. Let's kill him. Let's get rid of this guy. So if this were being written by us, I mean, we like plots and we like twists and turns, but this is just beyond bizarre. And that would not be how men would think as far as trying to write the story of Jesus' life. So as we look, we find credible witnesses. We also find a suitable number of witnesses. And we also find this. There is uniformity without any type of collusion. We've been hearing a lot lately about collusion. What happens when people collude?
They make up stories.
Oh, okay, not only do they make up stories. For example, if you know, you've got the police behind you and you're not honest. You've just stolen money from a bank, for example. Do you think that the two people in the car might be saying, hey, when the cop finally pulls us over, let's make sure we got the details of our story straight. You've got some collusion. You know, we were at Aunt Sue's house and, you know, we were baking cookies. Whatever it might be. But you're trying to get your story straight. And when people come in and they say almost, it's like kids, they do the same thing. And you get the same story from two different kids and it sounds like it's almost word for word. And boy, I mean, it just rolls off the tongue. You're thinking what? I know that you guys are guilty because the stories not only match, they match too well. So there's matching and then there is matching. And in this case, the details match, but there are also enough differences, variations, we've talked about that as well, to indicate that there was no collusion. And then finally this. We touched earlier on some of these passages, you would expect the disciples, if the resurrection had been true, and we affirm that it was, the disciples would have had what kind of reaction? Quickly, immediately. Joy? But that's not what you find. What do we look at? Okay, you would think that if the resurrection were true, and the disciples believe that, and we are affirming this truth, that we don't want to leave any doubt about that, what would the disciples' reaction have been initially? Well, but joy too, wouldn't you think? Oh yeah, he's been raised from the dead, great, let's move on. But that's not what we find. Here are the fellows who had spent 3.5 years with Jesus, as we made the point earlier in class. Who are the people who have some concerns about that? Well, it's the enemies, right? They're the ones who are trying to get the guard. Yes. Yeah. But it takes a little while for the disciples to get on board. And again, that's just not the way that we would have written the story. So as you look at the details, how they're expressed by God, you have to say it is not the way that we would have put this story together. And that's one more indication that it is of divine authorship. Anything that you want to add or ask as far as a closing comment or two? Okay.